This week we're going to be continuing our message series on reaching out. You know, again, I talked about it, you know, the third part of the vision for this year that God gave us is to be more connected with the world around us. You know, those outside these four walls. But obviously it's the very first part of the vision for the church overall. That's always going to be who New Hope is, right? You know, gathering in the lost, gathering in the lost. And so we're continuing this message series, and we're going to be learning in the series how we can be more effective at reaching people for Jesus. You know, that old hymn that I'd never heard of before this morning. I'm sorry. I didn't grow up in the church, but, yeah, that old hymn, you know, reaching out to people, telling them your story. Tell them about who you were before you met Jesus and who he is to you, you know, that story of your salvation. But we're learning how we can more effectively reach people for Jesus. Because if you haven't noticed, you know, lately, the church doesn't have a very good reputation for doing this. You know, people running away from the church, but they weren't running to Jesus. And so, you know, what is it that he did that was different than what we're doing now? And how can we change to be more effective at fulfilling the mission that God has given all of us to seek and save the lost? I mean, that's why we're here. We weren't saved just for our own selves. We're blessed to be a blessing. And too often we miss out on that. So, you know, and we talked last week about how you know, Jesus reached out to people where they were. He went out and fished with the fishermen, even though he was a carpenter. He went and he took an interest in people. And he was relevant to them, right? He was relevant to them. He called Peter, James, and John out from being fishermen to being fishers of men. Right? He didn't radically change who they were as far as their occupation or whatnot. He used what God created within them to reach people for the lost. And they were some of the greatest evangelists of all time, you know, because they had that mentality. We know how to fish, so now let's be fishers of men, fishers for people, you know. It was a natural progression that Jesus took advantage of. So that's who Jesus was, and that's what he did. So this week, we're going to be learning about an unbelievable invitation that is available to everyone. Available to everyone that most of us have already taken advantage of. Maybe some of us this morning haven't, but it's available right here, right now. As the Bible says, today's the day of salvation. And I love it because if God doesn't take you before tomorrow, then tomorrow, today's the day of salvation, you know, now. That's always a now word because in God's kingdom, it's always now. It's always here and now. It's never too late. You're never too far gone. Never too far lost. There's always hope, right? As long as you take another breath, there's hope. There is hope. But before we dive into this invitation that Jesus offered in the New Testament, we're going to go back to the Old Testament and to gain a glimpse of just how powerful this invitation truly is. This invitation, it's probably not lived out in a more powerful way than we see in a man with a super, super long name. And when I learned Hebrew, I learned it online. You don't learn how to pronounce things online unless you little click the little play button. And I'm just like, nobody got time for that. I don't know what it means. That's the important part, right? You know? No. The important part is learning how to pronounce it, but I didn't do that. So, his name is Mephibosheth. I'm going to call him M this morning, you know, just so I don't embarrass myself in front of you all more than I already have. But I love it because what you see happen so often, and this is the case this morning, is you see something in the Old Testament. It's like a lightning bolt. Whenever you see it, it's not like a light goes off and you're like, ding, wow, that is so cool. It's like a lightning bolt just boom, burst forth and just shatters who you are and the way that you see God and everything. You know, that thunder just rattles you and shakes you at your core. Like, that's what this kind of thing is. When something is prophesied in the Old Testament, Jesus talks about it, or you see it happen in the, you know, throughout the New Testament. And then it's also prophesied about something that's going to yet come. So it's something that happened a long time ago. It already happened. It's happening now, and it's going to happen. Like, it's just always. You know, that lightning bolt just goes straight through the Old New Testament, straight out to the end of days. And it's the same theme the whole way through. I just love it. It's like a thunderbolt just rips through everything, you know. You're like, wow, that is awesome, you know. And then you're like, well, I wonder if he knew that whenever he did that back then. God knew it. That's why he chose to record it. So anyways, this is a long, long story. So I'm going to give you the overview of it before we dive into it this morning. If you want to get ahead of me, turn to 2 Samuel chapter 9. And essentially, you have to read through all of 1 and 2 Samuel to get the context of what's happening here. So I'm going to give you the synopsis, the overview. Essentially, God rejected Saul as king of his people, right? The people, God was like, I'm your king. And the people were like, yeah, that's awesome, but we want to be like all the other nations. We want a man to be a king. We want a man to go ahead of us in battle. You know, yeah, you're cool and all, but, you know, we won't be like everyone else. And you know that that's just, you're asking for trouble when you choose that path to begin with. So God's like, all right, I'm tired of arguing with you, you know, because he's a good father. And sometimes you just give your children what they ask you for, almost just to allow natural consequence to set into effect. You don't want to eat your supper, you want to eat ice cream instead? Here's a bucket. All 5 quarts, have at it. Because we don't do the 4-quart buckets. Those are ripoffs. 5-quart buckets, you know. Have at it, you know. And then they're like, oh, I'm not feeling so good. It's like, told you, you know. Sometimes God's like that, you know. He's like, this is not good for you. You don't want this. I'm telling you, you don't want this. It will end badly for you. And yet we're like, but I want it, but I want it. And he's like, okay. And that's what he did with Israel. He's like, you want a man for your king? Here you go. And this wasn't just any man. He was tall and handsome, stood a head above everyone else, you know. He was a man's man, and from looking on the outside. But God knew what was inside of him. The day that they were going to ordain him as king, man, he was shivering and hiding somewhere. I didn't even want to go into that part of the story. But anyways, God rejected king as Saul of his Saul as king of his people. He rejected Saul. Saul just was not obedient to him. You know, God told him to do something and he half did it. And everybody knows, you got kids, when you tell your kids to do something, they half do it, they didn't do it, right? You know, it's no different in the kingdom of God. So God rejected Saul, king of his people. He chose David as a replacement. Saul hated David, you know, because people would sing songs, you know. Saul killed his thousands, but David his hundreds of thousands, you know. David is just, he was just always better than Saul at everything. You know, you got the nation quivering before the Philistines, and you got little young David. He's like, dude, what's your problem? He goes out there and he slays that giant, you know, Goliath. We all know the stories. Saul hated David, and he tried to kill him for a long time. But he just, it was the classic, you know, Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner scenario. Saul just could never catch him. And David had opportunity after opportunity to kill Saul and to take his rightful place as king, but he just didn't do it. He would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. He just would not do it. You know, and so time goes on. He tries killing and everything. Eventually, Saul kills himself. He just commits suicide. You know, he lands on his own sword, and it's really nasty and everything. Don't ever do that. That's what, you don't run with scissors, okay? Okay, kids? You don't run with scissors. Learn from Saul. But after that, war broke out between Saul's household and David's household. There was a vengeance. There was blood now to repay. And so Saul's family took it out on David's family. And that war just grew stronger and stronger until eventually it was an all-out war. However, eventually that war ceased. Okay? Long story. I tried to shorten it up a little bit. But that's where we are reminded of. When this war ceased. When David eventually became so strong that Saul's household became so weak that there was just no point in fighting anymore. And that's where we find this story taking place. Now, the only backstory that we hear about of M, this is where the backstory takes place, is, you know, that we read about him personally is right here in 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4. And it says this, Jonathan, son of Saul. Now, if you don't know Jonathan, he and David were BFFs. Even though he was the son of the man who wanted to kill him, they were just best friends, you know. I mean, it was just awesome, the friendship that they had. But Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. So, you know, the war that's taking place. This is a backstory here, a backflash. So this war is raging. So, you know, they're coming in. They know that David's family's coming in for blood to kill them. So whenever he's 5 years old, his nurse picked him up and fled. But as she hurried to leave, he fell and became disabled. And his name was Mephibosheth. Yeah, that, M. So this is his backstory. No fault of his own. This is Jonathan's own son. His nurse got up, tried to run for his life, tripped, fell, and he became disabled at the age of 5. Both feet were lame. You know, that's all that we know about him. Like, didn't have a very good life to start with. That's the backflash. And then we go ahead here to 2 Samuel chapter 9, and we're going to read through this. And so here, David asked, is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? You kind of get this picture. You know, the war has ceased, the fighting's over, and he's sitting there thinking about, man, you know, I can't stand the household of Saul, but Jonathan, I mean, we were friends, best friends. Is there anybody left that I can just bless at this point? I'm tired of war. I just want to bless somebody, you know, because of how much he loved Jonathan. I mean, they loved each other. It was that kind of, you know, it was a bromance, you know. They just, They're just that tight together. And in verse 2 it says, "Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' 'At your service,' he replied. The king asked, 'Is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?' Ziba answered the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan. He's lame in both feet.' 'Where is he?' the king asked. Ziba answered, 'He is at the house of Machir, son of Emmiel, in Lodabar.' So King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the household of Machir, son of Amiel. When Saul Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, and he bowed down to pay him honor. And David said, 'At your service,' he replied. 'Don't be afraid,' David said to him, 'for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table.' And bowed down and said, 'What is your servant that you should show, that you should even notice a dead dog like me?' Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said to him, 'I've given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And grandson of your master, will always eat at my table.' Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants." Talk about a change of lifestyle right there. "Then Ziba said to the king, 'Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do.'" Why would he be so obedient to the king? Because he knew what the king had the right to do otherwise, right? Just slaughter them right then and there. And so it goes on here and it says, "So ate at David's table like one of the king's own sons. Had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of And lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table." In case you didn't catch it, he was lame in both feet. And so here you see this picture happening. You know, Meshebabeth, who David could have killed, rightfully so. When he was brought before the king, instead of being killed, he instead received an invitation. An invitation to sit at the king's table like one of his own sons. An invitation into his family. An invitation to receive an inheritance of everything. Saul was a king, the first king of Israel. I mean, this dude was loaded, wealthy. Everything that was Saul's was freely handed to him. I mean, it's just a powerful transformation that takes place. And when he received that invitation to come before the king, to come before King David, you can imagine what went through his head. I mean, he probably said his last goodbyes to his son. He probably figured, this is it, I'm done. He probably figured he was brought before the king and that was it, the end of his life. And in the condition that he was in, lame in both feet, there was not a welfare system like we have today. Back in that culture, you were worthless, useless. All you were was a burden to everybody. Nobody wanted to be around you. You weren't even allowed near God's presence because you're crippled. I mean, it was just brutal back then. So you may have even had a little bit of excitement, like, you know, finally my misery is going to be over. You see, you get a picture of how he viewed himself, how highly he esteemed himself, because when he's brought into the king's presence, he's like, why would you even pay attention to me? I'm like a dead dog. He equated himself to a dead dog, useless, purposeless, worth nothing. I mean, instead of receiving what was due to him, King David instead, he just poured out this unbelievable blessing onto his life. He would never have to struggle again. He would never have to be ashamed again. He had, 15 sons and 20 servants working the land that was freely given to him. I mean, he just sat back and received the benefit of all this hard labor, and he didn't have to lift a finger. Not only that, he got to sit at the king's table like one of David's own sons. It's amazing. And in case it isn't recorded and repeated over and over and over again enough in the scriptures, you know, he was lame. He was disabled in both feet due to no fault of his own, due to the fault of his grandfather, Saul, who, screwed up and wouldn't obey God to be blessed. I mean, it's a messed up life that he lived. But imagine whenever he received that invitation to the king. I mean, literally, he was carried into the king's presence. There, as far as we know, there weren't wheelchairs back then. There probably weren't even crutches. I mean, dude couldn't use crutches. He couldn't put any weight on any of his feet, So he's carried. I don't know, either, Elijah, come here, bud. so you get this kind of picture. I mean, he was either literally physically carried, like this, carried to the king, or like, they had some people that had been through the Cub Scout program, Boy Scouts, and, they fashioned a, what you call it, that the paramedics use, a gurney, stretcher. Yeah, that's the word. Thank you. One or the other. I mean, he literally got carried into the king's presence. And his expectation of the king was just to slaughter him right then and there. Yet he was poured out such blessing. Unbelievable blessing. All of his days were going to be just rainbows and unicorns, And he was probably happier than a unicorn eating a cake on a rainbow. Yeah. But the cool thing is, when he was carried to the table, what happens to those lame feet whenever he would sit at the table with the king's sons? I mean, you can imagine King David here and all of his sons around. You're sitting there at the table eating with the king, and all of your shame, all of your brokenness, it's covered. It's hidden. Whenever he sat there at the table of the king, he was royalty. There was no difference between him and David's sons that sat around, because his feet were covered. You couldn't see that. You had no idea that he was lame and crippled. And all of a sudden, this man went from valuing himself as nothing more than a dead dog to becoming royalty. Filthy, rich royalty. People serving him at his beck and call. I mean, can you imagine the transformation that took place? How powerful that is. That by a simple invitation to sit at the king's table. Just a simple invitation. And that was nothing to David. It was a joy to David. It wasn't a burden. He didn't really lack anything. He had more than enough to go around to be able to meet everyone, every need of him. It's just a powerful picture that takes place, And now this invitation that David did. Now, this is, again, I'm thinking back and I'm wondering, did David really know what he was doing? Because if you didn't know it, and if you didn't pick up on it yet, this was a powerful prophetic act. This was an act that David might have just done out of the kindness of his heart, but God saw that simple act, and he's like, that's what my son's going to do. That's what Jesus is going to do for billions of people. He's going to carry people into my presence, and they're going to sit at my table, and all their shame, all their brokenness, it's covered. It is covered. They are royal children, though when I found them, they were nothing more than dead dogs heading straight for hell. How powerful is that prophetic act? And we see that take place here. The simple invitation. Now, I'm convinced that this event was at the forefront of Jesus' mind as he shared this parable. Now, we go ahead to the New Testament in Luke chapter 14. You see, we call it a parable. I don't believe this was a parable to Jesus. I think this is a prophecy that Jesus was speaking. Jesus never called it a parable. He says here, a certain man, you see, he was actually at a, a party and everything, to give you context, but in Luke chapter 14, verse 16, Jesus replied, and he said, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and had invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent a servant to tell all those who had been invited, come, everything's now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, well, I just bought a field and I got to go see it, so please excuse me. Another said, I just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. So please excuse me. Another said, I just got married, so I can't come. The servant came back and reported this to his master. And the owner of the house became angry. And he ordered his servant, go out quickly. Go into all the streets and alleys of the town. Bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame. Sir, the servant said, what your order has been done, but there's still room. The master told his servant, go out to the roads. Go to the country lanes. Compel them to come in so that my house will be full. And I tell you that not a single one of those who were invited will even get a taste of my banquet. Now, theologically speaking, just so I can clear the air on this, okay, I believe it is absolutely accurate and is commonly interpreted that Jesus is meaning, you know, that the salvation that was made available to the Jewish people, right, because the Jews were to be saved first, they rejected his salvation. They rejected that invitation. And so, of course, salvation then became available to all of, I think almost all of us in here are Gentiles, you know, non-Jews. You know, and I believe that's an accurate interpretation of what's considered to be this parable. However, I believe that there's a prophetic dimension to this, and I don't believe that Jesus meant that as a parable. I think Jesus is talking about an actual event that's going to take place, and I believe it applies to the church today. You see, because Jesus, King of Kings, has invited everyone to come to his royal table, right? Everyone to become his royal children. Literally, to adopt us into his kingdom. He's invited everyone to come sit at the feast of the wedding that's going to take place one day, right, between he and his church. He's invited everyone to inherit his kingdom. But how many who call themselves Christians, who call themselves by the name of Jesus, who've received this invitation, they're just simply too busy for him. They've got every excuse in the book. Look at all the families that are normally a part of New Hope that are missing here this morning. They had an excuse not to come this morning. They're too busy. I got this going on. I got that going on, you know. Something's better. Something better is happening. Man, can you imagine seeing Jesus face to face and telling him that? I'm just too busy. Something's more important than you. Sorry, you know. I believe Jesus is literally talking about the church. Too busy for him. Too busy to be like he was. You think Jesus wasn't too busy to come down to the earth? You think Jesus wanted to suffer the way that he did? You think he wanted to be hung on a cross, to be spit on and called names? You think he had too much to do, too important things, you know, much more important things to do than to do that? He saw that we were worth it. So why don't we see that he's worth it? Why don't we see that he is worth it? Because did Jesus continue to reach out to those who already knew him? Those people who already received the invitation. They're like, oh yeah, we're coming. They RSVP'd. Jesus, on the day that you come again, man, I can't wait to be in your presence. You know, they prayed the sinner's prayer. By the way, you'll never find a sinner's prayer in the Bible. Cover to cover, you look for it. I don't know where our church culture got that from, but you know, they prayed a sinner's prayer, so yes, they're saved. They're saved. They put their faith in Jesus. So they think, man, on the day you return, man, I'm good to go. Man, I can't wait to feast with you, Jesus, you know. They think they're good. How did Jesus respond to those people who RSVP'd, but when the time came, they're just too busy for him? When Jesus said, hey, there's this person out there that they really need me right now. I'm sending you. Go out, you know, go out and reach out to them. I'm sorry, Jesus, I'm too busy. I got things going on. We reject Jesus, but we think that when we stand before him, he's just going to welcome us right in. He's just going to shove that under the rug. You know, that, oh, I know you're too busy for me all your life, but yeah, let's kick back for eternity now. You're good. Come on. We all have friends that treat us that way. You don't want to give them the time of day. You know, after they've rejected you over and over and over and over again. How did Jesus respond according to his own word? He said not one of them, not a single one of them, will even have a taste of my banquet. And that was a pretty kind way of putting it. In the other parables he spoke, he said they're going to be spit out of my mouth. They're going to be where there's weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. He said it's better for them to have a millstone hung around their neck. Instead, they're going to be cast in the fires of hell. I mean, Jesus was pretty brutal about these things. And yet the church doesn't preach the actual gospel that Jesus preached. Because I don't want to hear it. Because I was crazy convicted when Jesus showed me this. Not by any means. In fact, they enraged him. He was enraged. What? What are all these excuses? You don't have time for me? Do you realize what I've done for you? What I've prepared for you? Wow. Instead, Jesus said, you know what? Go out to the roads. Go to the country lanes. Compel all them to come in. So my house is full. The lame, the crippled, the blind. I don't care what's wrong with them. Because remember in the Old Testament, they weren't allowed near the presence of God. All of a sudden, Jesus is like, if they don't have time for me, forget about it. Everyone who's willing, I don't care what's wrong with them, you have them come in. I'll take care of their problems. I'll heal them. I'll deliver them. You know, I'll take care of whatever it is that ails them so that they are worthy to sit in my presence. I will make them holy. I will make them worthy. I will cover them. And Jesus has told us to go and to compel people to come in. You see, I don't believe that this is a parable. I believe that what Jesus was referring to when he spoke this word was what he also told the Apostle John about in Revelation 19, the great wedding banquet at the end, when his church, those who are truly called by his name, those who stood firm in Jesus till the end, they receive their rich inheritance. They're invited to sit literally at the king's table, Revelation 19. I don't think this is a parable of Jesus. I think Jesus is telling us prophetically what is going to happen. When he has finished preparing a place for us, when he has finished preparing the banquet of the wedding feast, and he calls us all to come home, he knows who's too busy for him. He knows who has every excuse in the book to reject him all their lives.